Welcome to the Explanation Podcast, the show where the key to the future is a 217-year-old piece of technology. My name is Ian Stevens. I am a political scientist, activist, and I run a YouTube channel called The Lucretia Report.
And I am Silvia Salazar from Toro Latino. I love researching and learning what's going on in U.S. politics, so I can share that with you in a way that's pleasant and encourages a bit of activism.
Today we're going to be talking about passenger rail, America's passenger rail network and infrastructure, where it fails and where it could be better. And later in the show, we're going to be talking to Rick Harnish, who's the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance. If you want to follow the show on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at @explanation_pod, on Instagram at @TheExplanationPod, and on Facebook at @TheExplanationPodcast. And if you want to support the show, you can subscribe, leave a review and a rating, and share us with a friend.
We definitely want to hear what you think about the show. So tweet at us or send us a direct message on Instagram if that makes you more comfortable and tell us what you think about our episode so far.
And links to all of those social media handles will be in the episode description, and there will also be links to Sylvia and I's YouTube channels in the description where, if you would like, you can go and watch a video version of the interviews we do in these podcasts. All right, Sylvia, are you ready to get into it?
I can't wait.
So I'm going to read you a quote from the About page of Amtrak's website. Amtrak is the national train service in America. And at the very top of their About page, they say, with 21,000 route miles in 46 states and the District of Columbia and three Canadian provinces, Amtrak operates more than 300 trains each day. They obviously seem pretty proud of that. That's right at the top of their About page. But I'd like to give that a little bit of perspective. In 2019, Deutsche Bahn ran 23,466 passenger trains a day on 25,800 miles of track and with 7.1 million passengers a day.
Hold on. So we're talking about Amtrak with 300 trains per day versus 23,000 plus trains a day. And I don't remember the other numbers you mentioned before, but the differences are in orders of magnitude from each other.
Yeah, so Germany runs 78 times more trains each day than the United States. And this is just passenger rail, because Deutsche Bahn also runs freight, but we're talking specifically about passenger trains.
78 times more passenger trains per day. Oh my goodness.
They have 81 times more passengers per day. And all of that's despite Germany being much smaller than the United States, both in land area and population.
Is it horrible of me to think that it's kind of sad that Amtrak is proud of their 300 trains per day?
Well, I mean, I guess they have to advertise something. They're not going to put it on their website, 300 trains a day, which is not actually that much.
Yeah.
So the question I want to answer today is, why don't Americans ride trains? And it's not because we don't have the rail links. America actually has the largest rail network in the world by a lot. China, which is the second most, has 100,000 miles less of railroads than the United States. The problem is that most of that is not passenger rail. That's almost exclusively freight rail only. To give you a little bit of an idea of that, electrified rails will usually be for passenger rails. Of the 250,000 miles of railroads we have, only 2,000 of them are electrified. So only 1% of our rail lines are electrified. Almost all of the trains run in the United States are freight trains, and we're really good at that. We're just not very good at passenger trains. I think at the most basic level, you probably know already why Americans don't ride trains. Why do you think Americans don't ride trains, Sylvia?
Okay, Ian, I kind of cheated because I knew you were going to talk about trains today, and I couldn't come here completely unprepared. So I did a little bit of research, and I'm going to be honest, what I found completely blew my mind, because if you and I had made a bet, I would have lost, because I never, in my wildest dreams, come up with this answer. And I don't know if it's what you're going to say. I cannot believe that what I found is that a lot of this has to do with politics. And again, I'm like, wait a second. You ride your car to the station and you get on a train and you arrive somewhere else that's far away while somebody's taking you, you have the time to commute pleasantly. You don't have to fight with other drivers on the streets, or you can read the newspaper. You can even take a nap. What does that have to do with politics? And then I learned that people on the right consider cars freedom, and that riding trains is deferring to the will of the community, that you're like submitting these people, these riders, to what the community wants. And I'm like, wait, what? And that trains benefit mostly people in the cities that happen to be Democrats.
You know, it doesn't have to be like that, actually. We're going to talk about it later, but I think that trains would actually also be really good for rural areas. And I think that a big part of the political pushback against it is about size of government and the idea that if you invest very heavily to build a national rail network like Deutsche Bahn, for instance, that would be a massive government project, a massive part of the government. And it would not be something that's very appreciated by a lot of the current rail operators for some reasons that we're going to get into. They make a lot of money off of the existing railroads, and they own a lot of the existing railroads, and that might not be possible under a system that prioritizes passenger rail. So I did an experiment, and I actually did this experiment a while back because I know that the numbers might have gotten messed up by COVID. So I went back to the numbers for a previous thing I had made, and I looked at two trips, and they're actually trips that Amtrak is pretty good at. I looked at Boston to New York, and I looked at New York to Chicago. I looked at them about a month out from the date that I was looking at, and I compared riding the train to riding a plane. If you're going from Boston to New York, it's pretty competitive. The train is actually a lot cheaper. They start at about $29, and the plane starts at about $89. And the plane's prices vary a lot more, whereas the trains are much more consistent at different times of day. And the times are not super off. On a plane, it's going to take about an hour and 25 minutes of flight time. That's not including airport security, getting to the airport early, getting outside of the city to the airport. The train, it's going to take about 3.5 hours to 4.5 hours. So for a lot of people, especially factoring in all that extra time that's going towards the airport, that would be a pretty acceptable time scale. You can work on the train, so it's not lost time, but that's why Boston to New York is one of the only profitable routes that Amtrak has. It's one of their most popular routes and one of the ones that they're best at. New York to Chicago is a longer route, and you can really see the difference there. The price is still not that much different. Amtrak starts at about $90 for a ticket. The plane starts at about $83 for a ticket. But the real kicker here is the time. The plane takes about 3 hours to get from New York to Chicago. The train, depending on when you leave in the day, it varies from 19 hours to 28 hours on the train. Which, 28 hours for $90 actually seems like a pretty good deal to me. But also, when I first looked at it, they didn't even have a train from New York to Chicago on the day I'd originally looked at, which for a lot of people is already going to be a non-starter. So to possibly not be able to go on the day you want, when on a plane you can go basically anywhere on any day, and then take up to 28 hours, up to over a full day, you can see why people would opt to fly in very, very many circumstances, especially when outside of the Northeast, trains aren't even as good as they are in the Northeast.
It's like a no-brainer, especially, let's chip in, if you have a child with you, there's no way in hell I'm getting on a train for 30 hours with a child if I can get there 3 hours at, actually, you said cheaper, on a plane.
Yeah. I don't know if that really answers our question, though, because that's why people don't ride trains, is because they're not the best option in most circumstances. But I think a more important question is, why aren't trains the best option in most circumstances, when in a lot of countries, they are a better option in a lot of medium to shorter routes compared to a plane, whereas in America, it's usually better to fly, especially if you're outside of the Northeast Corridor. One reason that people talk about a lot is America's geography. America is not a very dense country. We talked about this in a stream we did, but America has a population density of about 34 people per square kilometer. That's far, far less than France and China, which are in the 100s, Germany and Japan, which are in the 200s and 300s, and India and the Netherlands, which are in the 400s. they have many more people in a much smaller area, and that allows them to have more destinations that are within a train kind of time scale, where riding the train will be often shorter than or a similar time to riding the plane. A better measure of this, I think, is something I made up, where I drew a 500-mile circle around the biggest city in each of these countries, and I looked at how many cities with over 500,000 people are in that circle. And the reason I chose 500 miles is 500 miles is the distance where, if you have trains running properly, in most circumstances, they will be comparable to or faster than flying. First of all, in France, Germany, and the Netherlands, the entire country is within that 500-mile radius. And in Japan, almost the entire country is within that 500-mile radius. But you have dozens of cities in Japan and China and India that are within that 500-mile radius, whereas in the United States, you only have six. So imagine that you're in New York, and you only have these very small number of options where you can go, and it's faster than flying or comparable to flying. Whereas if you're in China or Japan or Germany or India, you've got dozens of cities you can go to. You've got all of these different options. You can see how that makes a train more practical, right?
Yeah, you have places to go. You have options versus here. Apparently, you don't really have options.
So that is one of the challenges that we can't really solve, because we can't move cities closer together, right? And that's probably always going to be a problem for us. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this is impossible, because there are countries that are less densely populated than the United States, in fact, that have better passenger rail networks than us. The examples I brought up were Russia, Kazakhstan, and China, which are all much less densely populated than the United States. And Russia has a similar number of cities in that 500-mile radius. Kazakhstan and Saudi Arabia have far fewer. Kazakhstan only has one, other than its largest city of Almaty, that are within that 500-mile radius. And they all have better passenger rail networks than us. So you can get past that. The other big problem that Amtrak has is about the nature of its infrastructure. So in China, for example, most of its rail lines were built recently and largely explicitly for high-speed trains. In most countries, the government owns most of the rail networks. But in the United States, that's not the case. Most of our railroads were built a long time ago by companies that were focusing on, at least today they focus on, cargo trains. And so most of our railroads are not owned by the government. The vast majority of them, 97% of the track that Amtrak operates on, is privately owned. They're owned by BNSF, by CSX, by Union Pacific, by Norfolk Southern, which all own tens of thousands of miles, whereas Amtrak only owns a little over 600 miles of track. Most of the track that Amtrak owns is in the Northeast Corridor. It's in that Boston down to Washington, D.C. route. And it's no coincidence that that's some of their best trains and their most profitable trains in the country. Let me give you some reasons for that. Nationwide, Amtrak's got about a 60-70% on time rate. That's the number of trains that are on time. In the Northeast Corridor, that's about 90%, which is comparable with Deutsche Bahn, which runs 93.1% of their trains on time. Amtrak says that most of those delays are because of freight trains. Because the freight trains are owned by the same companies that own the tracks, BNSF owns trains and they own tracks, they can prioritize which trains are moving along the track. And if there is a freight train that's trying to make great time to bring a haul of lumber to the port, then they can tell Amtrak that they have to pull over and make way for that freight train. And the freight train will get there in great time, but Amtrak's gonna get delayed. And if that happens over and over, you see how that builds up. Especially on their longer routes that go for sometimes thousands of miles, that can happen numerous times. Sometimes you'll be pulled over to the side for up to hours, and that makes it really hard to predict when a train is going to get to where, which adds more disincentive for people to ride trains if they don't know if, oh, is this train going to be on time at this station, or is it not going to get here for another hour?
I would absolutely hate that. That just makes it completely unreliable. If I take the train from Portland to Seattle, let's say, pretend, but there's a freight train that needs to get there faster and they push me over to the side and make me sit there for 2 hours, I would have gotten there faster with my car.
Yeah, it makes me think of buses that I used to ride between the airports and college when I was in college. And I don't know if I can name this company, but you know the company that owns all the buses. They were never on time, and they don't even have an excuse. They're on roads. So freight carriers will tell you that freight has to be prioritized because good freight trains give a competitive edge to farmers and manufacturers, and because not allowing freight to be prioritized on the rails would lead to increasing traffic on the roads, increasing fuel consumption, and increasing pollution. And as they put it, that would defeat the point of what a lot of environmental activists want to get out of passenger rail anyway. I think it's pretty clear that the real reason freight trains want to prioritize their own trains is because it makes a lot more money. Another problem with the nature of our rail system is that they weren't designed for high-speed rail because they were largely designed before high-speed rail exists. So very little of our track can support that. Even if we did want to have a lot of high-speed rail, the existing track that we have would have to be completely overhauled or rebuilt to allow for high-speed rail. High-speed rail tracks usually have gentler turns. They're usually more sharply banked because the trains are moving much faster. They'll have barriers of some kind a lot of the time, as a little space on the side of the track or a little barrier fence for safety. And they're almost always electrified. Most of our freight rails have none of those features. So you just can't run high-speed trains on them. Even the Acela Express, which is our only quote-unquote high-speed train, is much slower than high-speed trains in a lot of countries, but our only quote-unquote high-speed train in the Northeast Corridor, it only reaches its top speed for two short little segments of its entire route. The entire rest of the route, it spins well below that speed, in not much faster than any other Amtrak in any other part of the country.
So you're telling me that we have rails that were built a long time ago for freight trains, and companies like Amtrak can use those for passenger trains, but then those trains have to go at specific speeds because they can't go up due to the limitations of the track. And if we wanted something like high-speed trains, we would have to modify all of the existing tracks or build new ones. Would the freight trains be able to ride on the new ones, or would you need both?
You would probably need both because the tracks would probably have to be electrified. And I don't know, maybe replacing freight trains with electric models is a good solution that will decrease pollution, but I don't necessarily see freight companies investing in that. To have a national high-speed rail network, what you would probably need to do is build a lot of new high-speed rail track. So another problem that Amtrak has is that they are not completely a government entity. They're a government-owned corporation, kind of like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, where they're heavily subsidized, but they're expected to make a profit still. And in addition to some of the challenges we've already talked about, where there are very few options for profitable routes because of our geography, and the trains are often unreliable and delayed, and because they can't move as quickly as they want to, it's already very hard to make a profit. Add on to that the fact that Amtrak is both expected to make a profit and to provide a public service the way governments do. So Congress is not going to cut routes that serve their constituents, even if they're not profitable. People who want Amtrak to make a profit would look into cutting a lot of the longer routes where very few people ride a train instead of fly, and focus on some of the shorter routes or developing new routes that would probably be profitable, like Las Vegas to Los Angeles or Dallas to Houston, which are some ones that they have planned with the stimulus money upcoming, but we'll talk about that. But Congress isn't going to let them do that, because if you're a congressman from Colorado or a senator from Colorado, you don't want your constituents to lose train service. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's what governments are for. But you can't expect Amtrak to do that and expect them to make a profit. So what happens is that they get stuck in another circle where they lose money, and then they have to cut services, or they can't make upgrades, and then service gets worse, and then fewer people ride the trains, and then they lose more money, and the entire cycle starts all over again. So I think those are some of the main reasons that Amtrak service is not on par with a lot of other countries. I want to go over real quick why trains are such a good thing, though. The first reason why trains are such a good thing is because they are substantially better for the environment. They have 1/7 of the amount of carbon emissions per passenger mile as riding a plane does, and 1/5 of riding a car. So every passenger that you get out of a plane or a train is taking a lot of carbon emissions out of the atmosphere. And that's based on diesel trains. That's not based on if you have an electric train that's powered by wind power or whatever, where it would be basically zero carbon emissions to operate, only the carbon emissions that it would take to build the trains. So for example, if you traveled from New York to Chicago by diesel train, not even these electric trains we're talking about, you would save over 200 kilograms of CO2. That's about the weight of a grizzly bear. The weight of a grizzly bear in CO2 for each passenger going from New York to Chicago that rides a train instead of flying in a plane. Another reason is that within certain ranges, it would oftentimes be faster than flying. You see, planes can go faster than trains can, but planes take a lot longer time to get up to speed, and then they have to slow down a lot earlier. Trains can speed up relatively quickly, and then if they're on the right tracks, maintain that speed for a long time, and then start slowing down when they're relatively near to their stops. So if you're within a usually about 500 miles or less range, you can actually get to most places faster on a train than on a plane if it's running well and fast, especially when you also account for airport security, getting to the airport, waiting at the airport, all of those things that go along with flying in the modern age in the post 9/11 world. So a lot of the times it would be faster to ride a train than to fly. It would support rural communities, is what I was talking about earlier, where I said that it doesn't have to be all for cities, because there are a lot of communities out there that aren't big enough to support an airport. Whether you have one plane a day flying out of an airport or 1 million planes a day flying out of an airport, I don't know if there are any airports that big, but no matter how many planes you have, you have to have airport security, you have to have firefighters, you have to have air traffic control, you have to have all of these different services that are distributed among however many passengers you have, whether that's a teeny tiny little number or a very large number. And if you have to have all of that stuff, it means it becomes exorbitantly expensive to have airports in rural communities. If you've ever done much flying out of rural communities, you know that. When I was in college, I used to fly out of Burlington, Vermont all the time, and it got very expensive. It was cheaper to fly into Boston and then take the bus to Burlington than it was to fly into Burlington. With a train station, you don't have that, because train stations are usually just a little building, maybe a couple of people work there. You might have one person on a shift working there. And in a rural train station, that's all you really need. So it's not nearly as much expense to distribute amongst the passengers, which means that in a lot of rural communities, trains are the best option for mass transportation. The current Amtrak trains we have now stop in a lot of these tiny communities and support them. I'll give you an example. The Portland to Seattle train, since you live in Portland, it stops in Vancouver, Washington, Kelso, Longview, Centralia, Olympia, Lacey, Tacoma, and Tukwila. Do any of those cities have an airport, as far as you're aware, Sylvia?
No. The airport would be the Portland airport. A lot of Vancouver people come down, obviously, because it's just on the other side of the Columbia River. Mm-hmm. And Tacoma is closer to the Seattle airport. So you would probably drive up north to the Seattle International Airport. And I don't remember, which ones were the other ones you said? Olympia?
Very small towns. Centralia, Tukwila, I think it's called. Very small towns.
They would probably choose like whether they want to drive down to Portland or drive up to the Seattle International Airport. Seattle is much bigger than the Portland airport, so they probably have more choices, honestly.
Yeah, and so if you're living in one of those communities, if the trains are running well, which Oftentimes they aren't right now, but they could in the future if the trains are running well. It's in a lot of circumstances going to be easier for you to ride the train than for you to drive all the way to Portland or all the way to Seattle and then fly. And those aren't even the most isolated communities that Amtrak serves. Those are between two major cities. Amtrak also serves cities like Winnemucca, Nevada, Oskello, Iowa, McCook, Nebraska, and Malta, Montana, which are nowhere near any major cities that have an airport. So this doesn't have to be just an urban left thing. This can be something that supports the rural communities that are voting for the people that largely are voting against building out these rail systems. Building up these rail systems could also decrease traffic. If you have more people getting into trains, you have fewer people driving, you have fewer people on the roads. And for many people, it would just be a better option. They just prefer it. A lot of people would think it's more comfortable, that it's more convenient. You can get up and walk around. There's a dining car. They've got better seats. There's free Wi-Fi. You can open a window. There's a nicer view. A lot of people would just prefer to ride a train than to fly a plane. And they should be able to have that option. If you're all about capitalism providing as many options to people as possible, then people should have the option to ride a train if they want to. So what needs to be done to make this network better? The first thing we probably need to do is we need to stop expecting Amtrak to make a profit. We don't expect the military to make a profit. We don't expect Social Security to make a profit, or public schools, or most roads, because they're government services. Because we recognize that it's good for society to have schools and roads. And because they're things that will probably never make a profit. Just like in America, having a good rail network that serves people in places like Winnemucca, Nevada, will probably never be a profitable thing to do. But we shouldn't expect them to. We should support them like a government service with tax revenue. And then if we do that at the right levels, then they can afford to improve their service. But that's the thing. We're also going to need a ton of money. So Amtrak put out this new map when Biden started talking about his infrastructure proposal, which gives a lot of money to railroads. And this map has some cool new routes. It's got Riverside, California to Las Vegas, Phoenix and Tucson. It's got Dallas to Houston. It's got a route from Nashville to Savannah by way of Chattanooga, Atlanta, and Macon. But there's not nearly enough money in this infrastructure bill for what this route proposes. In total, there's about 7,500 miles of new route in this map, plus about 21,000 miles of existing routes that Amtrak uses. The Washington State Department of Transportation, they estimated that it would cost about $80 to $140 billion per mile to build high-speed rail. So if we take a middle estimate of that for all the new rails, and we have to upgrade that 21,000 if we want to make a national high-speed rail network, right? So let's be very conservative. Let's take the lower end of that and make it like half, just to give us a round number. That comes out to $1.5 trillion to build out this entire map as high-speed rail. And a lot of people would say that even that map is not enough.
Can you repeat the numbers? Because you said about 7,500 miles of new railways, and then 21,000 of existing railways, and then you're going for like a middle ground, estimating how much it would cost, but you also said that we would have to invest in the existing ones, and I want to know why? Because you said that the high-speed rails would need completely new rails, and we can just keep the freight trains where they are in the existing ones. So that's where I'm kind of confused.
Yeah, so this is based on the idea that you're trying to upgrade these routes to make them as fast as possible. So this is actually going to be a cheaper option than building out that 21,000 miles as completely new high-speed rail networks. This is basically trying to do as much as you can to the existing rails to make them as optimized as they can be for as high of speed as you can get passenger rails. So this is actually a cheaper option than laying out that entire 21,000 miles as new high-speed rail track. And this still comes out to about $1.5 trillion. For perspective, the Biden plan only has about $80 billion. So it's going to take an enormous amount of money to do this. And a lot of people would say that that map from Amtrak is not even ambitious enough, that it's missing a lot of segments. We're going to talk about that later with our guest. But one thing you would probably want to do, for instance, is upgrade all of Amtrak's thruway connecting services, which are networks that currently run mostly on buses to bring you, to give you a few more options of staying within the Amtrak network, riding a train and then getting on a bus to go to somewhere where the trains don't go. To give you an example of something in your area, they have an Amtrak thruway connecting service that runs from Portland over to the coast on Cannon Beach and then up to Warrenton and then to Astoria. And a lot of people would say that you should do something like building out all of those as trains as well, so that you really do have options to go to most places in America by train. It would also open up a lot more routes within that 500 mile radius where most people will be riding trains, whereas Amtrak's current network in most parts of the country is almost designed for longer range routes.
I like what you said about the buses, because that's a problem that immediately popped in my head. Okay, if I can take Portland to Cannon Beach, great. But when I get to Cannon Beach, what am I going to do? Like, how am I supposed to move around if there's not enough public transportation options in Cannon Beach? That makes me think, oh, I should have just brought my car.
Yeah, so I don't know Cannon Beach in particular. If I were designing this, I would want this to be paired with a lot of public transportation development. I didn't bring that into this because I thought that's a whole topic of its own. But Biden campaigned on building public transportation network in any city with over 100,000 people, which is a lot of cities in America. I think it was over 300 cities. There's also not nearly enough money in the infrastructure bill to do that. But if we're putting, you know, $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion, however many trillions of dollars into building out a rail network like this, I do think it makes sense to also build out public transportation networks in the destination cities, to build out subways and light rails and buses. So that, like you said, you can get there and then get off the train and still go places. I used to live in China. I lived in Tianjin, and what you could do was you could ride the Tianjin subway to the train station and then ride the train to whatever city. And in most of those cities, that train station will connect to the subway station in the local city. I did going to Beijing once. I rode the subway to the train station. It was like a 40-minute high-speed rail train to Beijing. And then I didn't even go outside before I was on the Beijing subway to go wherever I wanted to do. And in fact, in cities like that, in like Beijing and Tianjin that are relatively close to each other, there are a lot of people who commute between those two cities. And that's probably a similar distance to like Portland to Seattle if people lived in Portland and worked in Seattle and commuted every day.
Well, given that, for example, Portland houses are a lot cheaper than Seattle houses, if there were options on a high-speed train, I know that a lot of people would probably live here and commute to Seattle. It wouldn't surprise me because I already know some of them that they have to, and they have to do it by car because there's no alternative. But if you give them a high-speed train option, it would be amazing.
That sounds awful. How long does that drive take?
Theoretically, about 3.5 hours, but there's always a huge amount of traffic in Tacoma. So it could take you 4 hours or more, depending on the day and time.
Oh my God, that sounds miserable. I didn't even think about people doing that in cars today. Oh, wow. I'm sorry. That just blew my mind.
My husband has a few coworkers that are based in Portland, but they have accounts in Seattle and they have to go there a couple times a week. So imagine that, I mean, let's say 4 hour or 3.5, 4 hour drive there and back. That's 16 hours sort of per week just in your car.
Yeah, so we talked about how for most of these tracks, if you were really serious about it, you would probably want to build new tracks to support high-speed rail. You wouldn't be able to do that everywhere. There would be some places where the existing tracks are the best or only option. And so you would probably have a mix of new routes, upgrades, and I think a necessary part of this would probably be that you would have to nationalize some of the rail services. Some of the places where it's not practical or not the best option to build a new track, you would want to buy, you would want the government to buy those up from the private companies. And I don't mind if the companies are still running their trains on it. I don't even mind if they do that for free. But we should be prioritizing passengers over cargo, I think. Because if your lumber shipment is 2 hours late, that's not nearly as big a deal to you as if you are 2 hours late somewhere. You talked about if the train is going to take that long, you can't bring your kids on the train, you can't bring small children, or that's going to be a huge headache. It's not that big a deal if your Amazon package is one more day, or even not even one more day, if it's a few more hours late. Do you see my point there?
Oh, completely.
And so the last thing you're going to have to think about if you're being really serious about building out this system is you're going to have to think about the future. It's all well and good if you build a system, but then if you don't give enough money to maintain it, then service is going to degrade and people are going to stop riding it. And gradually, you're going to get back to a point that's not so dissimilar to the point we're in now. So after you build out that system, you're going to have to keep giving it enough money that they can maintain and upgrade their tracks and their trains, that they can hire enough staff to maintain a good service, and that they can keep their trains running regularly and on time. Because as soon as the trains stop running regularly and on time, that's a major factor that's going to encourage people not to ride the train anymore. So I guess the note I want to leave on is that they have networks that are better than ours all over the world. There are densely populated countries, the Netherlands, there are very sparsely populated countries, there's Russia, there are big countries and small countries like China and Austria, rich countries like Japan, poor countries like Kazakhstan, countries of every government type, countries that have built them in the past and in the present, countries of all different geographies all around the world. And they've all been able to do it. So it's not a matter of any factor that's going to make it where that we can never do this. It's a matter of the government's will to invest in this and to be really serious about this. So we can do this if we want to. We just have to decide that we want to.
Okay, so I think the best thing we can do right now is talk to an expert on high-speed rail.
Well, Rick Harnish is the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance. That is a nonprofit group which advocates to build a nationwide, high-quality, high-speed rail network in the United States. And he's here to talk to us today. All right. Hi, Rick. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, the first question I want to ask is about the infrastructure bill that the White House is trying to pass right now. The bill allocates about $80 billion for Amtrak, and Amtrak put out this map showcasing what they hope to do with that money with some really exciting routes, a bunch of upgrades and all of that. But what I want to ask you is what you think of that level of spending and what can be done with $80 billion? Is it enough to do what Amtrak says they'd like to do? And how should they prioritize all of these many, many projects that they'd like to do?
To be clear, the Biden administration proposed $80 billion in spending on railroads, not only on Amtrak. And Amtrak has its own proposal for expanding routes across the country. We are very happy that Amtrak is proposing to expand its route network. We think they've got a good proposal in terms of the map. There's a couple of pieces missing, but we need something that's much more aggressive than what Amtrak is proposing.
What do you think can be done with that money, with $80 billion? How far can that get?
Well, so it's a good starter network, or a good start, and it could leverage state and private money. So it's not really clearly defined yet. But it's basically the minimum of what we need to do to get decent train service in this country.
Rick, how many jobs do you estimate would be generated by those $80 billion of the infrastructure bill dedicated specifically to the rails?
I'm sorry, I haven't seen any estimates yet. Gobs and gobs of jobs would be created.
Well, when I was researching this, I saw that back in 2010, the $2 billion project for Florida that governor at the time, Rick Scott, killed would have generated around 27,500 jobs. So like you said, this would generate thousands and thousands of jobs. So since we don't know how many of those would generate, I have a different question for you, because there's a lot of possibilities of high-speed rail projects, but obviously you have to prioritize. Which ones would you prioritize? Which ones would be at the top of your list?
So California is under construction. So that is an immediate win. Bright Line from Las Vegas to LA is ready to go. There's, you know, a couple of not quite high-speed rail projects in the Midwest that could be quickly done. But really what we need to do, in addition to those quick wins, and also some immediate fixes to the existing Amtrak network, we really need to take care of the big high-leverage stuff, like the first 90 miles out of Chicago to the east, south, and to the north. Really getting planning underway on Atlanta to Charlotte. A couple of critical bridges on the Northeast Corridor. And most importantly, right away, replacing any passenger train in this country that's older than 20 years old.
I wonder, you talked about that the Amtrak map had a lot of great stuff in it, but you said there were still a few gaps. Could you talk about where you think it should be more ambitious than it is?
The immediate thing that comes to mind is Nashville to Louisville. So the Federal Railroad Administration did a plan for the Southeast, and they did a plan for the Midwest, and those plans meet at Nashville. And it's very disappointing that Amtrak didn't see that very obvious connection.
Is there a model that you would draw from abroad? People, a lot of times, they give examples of great high-speed rail systems in countries like France, Germany, China, and Japan get brought up a lot. Which one do you think would be the best inspiration for the U.S. to draw from? And what should we be looking at taking from each one?
Well, each circumstance is different. And even within countries, each route is slightly different. Each segment is slightly different. We should certainly take inspiration from Turkey. If Turkey can build high-speed rail from the Mediterranean up that really steep climb up to the plateau where Ankara is, we can do high-speed rail in this country. But the key lesson is, probably if you look anywhere in the world, there is a solution for the specific problem in your route. So we really need to look at it overall in a big picture way.
Is there a more a systematic approach towards high-speed rail that any of these countries have that you think we should draw inspiration from in a systematic level rather than looking at it route by route?
No, really, the systematic level is the critical piece. And that's part of why we haven't moved forward in this country, because it's all been segment by segment. But people don't travel in discrete city pairs. They travel all across the country. So we really do need a master plan at three different levels, the state, regions, and the national level. And, you know, you're not going to build new high-speed tracks everywhere, but certainly all 49 states on the continent need better train service, and including substantial upgrades to the Alaska Railroad.
And you're talking about the 49 states and the continent. How much do you think that the American high-speed rail network would be integrated with Canada and Mexico, for instance, or even possibly further down into Central America, if that's practical? I know Amtrak has some limited operations in Canada. How much do you think that those should be separate systems compared to how much should they be working together?
You know, we built I-69. Which in a lot of places was redundant and not needed, but they built it based on this idea of connecting Ontario to northern Mexico, essentially, and everything in between. We certainly should be doing that with high-speed rail, looking at Monterrey, Laredo, San Antonio, Dallas, Memphis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, Toronto, Montreal.
I have a question for you. And I tried to get the answer, but I couldn't find it. So you're like the best person here. I know that in Europe, for example, there's companies for building highways that they take the cost of building the highway and they recover the costs through tolls. And since a lot of the argument against building high-speed rail is that it takes a lot more time and it's a lot more expensive than estimates. Is there something similar for building high-speed rail so that a private company could build part of it and, I don't know, make some of the money back from ticket sales or something like that?
Well, remember that most highway projects take longer than they were anticipated and have huge cost overruns. So there's an interchange here in Chicago that is years, and I had the experience of driving through that construction zone last week. So years behind schedule. That's just part of the way we build highways in this country, right? We put billions and billions of general revenue into the highway trust fund every year. So this amazing thing is that there are private projects that are willing to compete with the publicly owned and subsidized highway network. That just shows how much more efficient high-speed rail is than driving. And certainly there are different models in different places, but the hardest part always is acquiring the land. And if there's an agency that's building a toll road overseas, typically the government is providing the land.
So with high-speed rail being a lot more expensive than non-high-speed passenger rail, in your model, would there be a place for, what would the word be, normal-speed passenger rail, I guess, like what Amtrak's current offerings are? Especially for shorter routes, like if you look at Chicago to Detroit, for instance, that you could potentially get a much cheaper construction, perhaps cheaper ticket prices. Would there be a place for that in your model?
So basically, it's going to be about 20% new high-speed track running at 200 miles an hour and 80% working with freight railroads to run higher frequency service at 80 miles an hour. But the difference between what is reasonably achievable on the existing railroad between Chicago and Detroit is about 4.5 hours, 5 to 10 times a day. What you get out of dropping that under 2 hours and having a train every hour, plus an express train during the peaks, half hours, you get 10 times ridership, 10 times the value. So plus, that would be part of, if you did it the way most people have talked about it, that would be part of Chicago-Toledo, Toledo-Detroit, Toledo-Cleveland, Chicago-Cleveland, Detroit-to-Cleveland, Chicago-Cleveland-Toronto. So you put a lot of volume over that infrastructure, and you can only do that by building new infrastructure in those key places.
Can you talk a little bit about how working with the freight railroads, what that relationship would be like in your estimation? Because I know there are a bunch of issues with the freight railroads and prioritizing their own trains for obvious reasons and with who's in control of repairs and all of that. So can you talk about what the relationship between the probably mostly government-sponsored high-speed rail would be and the private railroads that they operate on now, and it sounds like would operate on in your model as well?
So the fundamental problem with Amtrak today is that they have legal right to the best service, much higher quality than any of the railroad's customers, and pay dramatically lower rates than any of the railroad's customers. That's a fundamental flaw that we have to fix. You can't legislate somebody taking that big of a hit. And so that's the piece that has to be fixed.
How would you look at any proposals to nationalize some of those railroads?
It would be incredibly difficult to do, very expensive. And it would go against 200 years of history in this country. So it's an interesting thing to debate.
I mean, there are railroads that are owned by the government now, and there is a history of some infrastructure being nationalized in the past. So, I mean, do you think that that would make it, do you think that that would be a worthwhile thing to do? Do you think that would improve service or be worth the money?
That's really difficult. That's beyond my ability to speculate. But it is true, there are a lot of publicly owned railroads, primarily dedicated to passenger trains. There's a couple of publicly owned freight railroads, actually, Cincinnati to Chattanooga and across northern Carolina. But it's just too big of a scale to discuss at this point, but it certainly is one option.
Rick, I saw some numbers that argue that it costs between 1 and 4 cents per driver to invest in highways versus something like 13 cents per rider to invest in railways. But we know that there's an environmental cost that I don't think it was in that equation. What arguments do you have to combat those talking points? What can we help people learn to argue against those numbers?
That those numbers are complete baloney. Look at, for example, right now, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, $110 billion to add one more lane in each direction on I-5. Less than half of that to build high-speed rail. The added lane on I-5 doesn't do much for you. High-speed rail cuts the travel times in half. The people who use those numbers are very selective in the costs, and it really is baloney.
Well, you just picked the right example, because I'm in Portland and I drive to Seattle and it's a nightmare. And you can add more lanes, but there's always this pile of cars around Tacoma and there's nothing you can do about it.
And I'm really happy with the work of strongtowns.org. They have demonstrated that a large part of the reason that our communities all across the country are having such huge fiscal problems is because we've simply built too many roads, and it's destroying the finances of our cities and towns. And the people who are advocating for more highways choose not to look at all of those costs.
How easy is it to affect those? Because you were giving per rider and per driver numbers, Sylvia. So how easy is it to affect those with passenger numbers? You talked earlier about increasing passenger loads with the example of Chicago to Detroit by making it high speed instead of a slower train. How quickly does that have an impact on the cost per rider? Is it something that works around the margins, or is it something that is one of the main factors in that?
Well, the key to running trains is to put a lot of people on, which is interesting because that means actually you have to run a lot of trains. So you really have to get across a tipping point in terms of frequency and speed. But once you're there, it becomes very exciting. So just like in the first phase of California high-speed rail, it's very interesting. They're going to double the amount of riders on that system and actually lower the cost of running the system. Because essentially, the first segment of high-speed rail will replace a section of Amtrak service that already exists. And then everything that feeds into that, 3 different train routes, 5 to 10 bus routes, they all get increased service as well. And because of that additional frequency, so many more people will ride it that the cost of running the system, even though you're running a lot more trains carrying a lot more people, actually goes down.
You're talking about the California high-speed rail. That's one that critics bring up a lot also, because the California high-speed rail has been far behind schedule, far over budget, and they've been talking about cutting back on what the original plans are. So can you talk about some of the problems that they've run into in California, and how would you push back against criticism that leverages the problems they've seen in California as an argument that high-speed rail is not worth it?
So first of all, let's go again to the Jane Byrne interchange in Chicago, which is years behind schedule and over budget by a lot. You know what? I'm going to argue that people shouldn't drive, because we just can't build highways. That's number one. Number two, the plan is and always has been San Francisco to LA in 2 hours and 40 minutes. That is under construction now. All that's changed is the phasing of it. And the biggest challenge goes back to the land. And you have to be very aggressive about understanding what land you need and how you're going to get it up front. And that's the key issue.
Chinaman is probably the most impressive expansion of their high-speed rail network that we've seen. At least very few countries do, if there have been any other countries that have accomplished a similar feat, building tens of thousands of miles of rail in a very short amount of time. A lot of people, though, say that that's only possible because of the authoritarian nature of China's government, the ability to dictate to lower authorities and not have to squabble between parties or to try to source funding from state legislatures and such. Do you think that it's possible to achieve that kind of feat in civil engineering, the way that the American government is structured, to build up a nationwide system in that kind of time scale? And if it is possible with the way the government is structured, is it possible in this current political landscape?
So the reason we have such onerous environmental regulations in this country is because the interstate highway destroyed so many viable neighborhoods. It destroyed so much natural beauty. And all that the folks in favor of keeping strong, healthy neighborhoods could do was slow the process down. We really couldn't change the process. So, you know, when we built I-55 here in this state, the marshals went in and carried people out of their homes so that they could come in and build the highway. We probably don't have that kind of gumption anymore, but that doesn't mean we can't do high-speed rail right. We can do high-speed rail. And part of the answer is to use, where possible, unfortunately, a lot of places the highways are too curvy, but there's a lot of right-of-way out there that can be used for doing high-speed rail.
Rick, for those of us who are fans of trains and high-speed rails, what can we do to help? Like, do we contact our representatives and push specific bills? What can we do to gain more support for this and make it happen?
So right now is when the debate is happening. It's happening now. It'll be happening for the next couple of months. Given the way Washington works, it may stretch out, but we're thinking in the next couple of months. And one of the best things you can do, not only get a group of friends who all live in the same congressional district and go meet with your congressman, that's step one. Step two, go to your local mayor and persuade your mayor to get a resolution through the city council. Those kinds of things are what we need to do in order to make it happen.
What has your organization been doing to try to lobby the government to invest more in this? Can you talk about some of those things?
Really, what we've been doing is educating people around the country about why this is so important and what needs to happen in order to make it happen. People can get engaged and we can help them know what they can do. If they go to our website, highspeedrail.us, so high-speed rail, obviously, .us, that's where we want it, here for us. And there's a petition they can sign that will also get them on our email list.
And you seem very optimistic about the prospect of building high-speed rail, but I wonder how optimistic you are about this current push that you said the debate's happening right now. And how much do you think we can get out of that? Do you think $80 billion is the ceiling of what we can get to? Or do you think that we can potentially get more than that?
Now, just to be clear, one thing that happens with these proposals when they're debating them is they give you a top line number and then they don't tell you how many years. Sometimes it's 4 years, sometimes it's six. You know, in this case, it's $80 billion over 10 years. That makes it $10 billion a year. That really needs to be the floor. We need to be much bigger. We have a crisis in this country. We've got a financial crisis. We've got an environmental crisis. We need to really reinvent the way we do business. We need to do it now, not 10 years from now. It really needs to happen now.
Have you seen leaders that you've been engaging with that are reflecting the same kinds of attitudes?
So we're very excited about the administration's push. That's great. Congressman Moulton from the Boston area has been the clear champion. Congressman Chuy Garcia from Chicago has been a huge champion for transit. And Costa out of California has been very, very strong.
Rick, I have to be honest, I was really surprised because when I was researching this, I ran into something completely unexpected, which was that this becomes like a political issue. It never would have occurred to me that this became about politics and that the right argues that cars provide you with freedom and that trains make you, you know, submit to the will of the community and whatnot, and that the Koch brothers have poured millions of dollars into killing these projects. So what is your take on that part? Because I mean, there's even like this war on trains term that I never would have known existed.
Yeah. So see, the problem is if you have strangers intermingling for a period of time, they will talk to each other and then they will get ideas. And, you know, maybe they're not listening to talk shows as much and getting the ideas from talk shows. So really, you don't want people intermingling if you're of that fear. The other thing is, our existing system makes a lot of money for a few people, and it makes a decent amount of money for a lot of people, right? Think about it. There's a tire shop in every congressional district. There's an asphalt dealer. You know, it's a system that costs a lot, and because it costs a lot, there's people who make money on it. And trains will be much more efficient. And so basically, that's the challenge, really, when it comes down.
So trains are revolutionary.
Trains are revolutionary, yes.
All right. Well, before we finish up, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Our website again, hsrail.us. Love to hear from folks. This is really a critical time. Please check it out.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure.
All right, what do you think of that, Sylvia?
That was really enlightening. I didn't know much. Let's be honest. I didn't know anything about high-speed rail before your presentation, just a little bit of homework that I did, and our conversation with Rick. So it was really enlightening.
What Rick said right at the end there, I'd never thought about that, about the idea that if people are congregating in one place and they're going to start talking to each other and spreading new ideas that might be out of the mainstream, it's like a whole new public square. And I guess we do that on social media now, but I had just never thought of it like that. And it makes me think of an experiment. I think it was in Boston that some people did a while back, where they were trying to test whether exposure to immigrant groups made people more racist. And they found that right at first, if a bunch of immigrants moved into the community, then there was an uptick of anti-immigrant attitudes. But over time, as they were exposed to them on the train or in the coffee shops or whatever, then over time that decreased. And I wonder having that congregation like that, instead of having a bunch of people individually in their cars, could do something like that on a wider scale.
Yeah, that's a good point. Also, I mean, I'm all for trains. If somebody else can take me from here to there and I can take a nap and not be constantly aware of everybody else driving and people cutting each other on the road, that's a big win for me.
Honestly, that 3-hour each way commute, 4 hours of traffic that you talked about between Portland and Seattle, I just don't know how people do that. At what point do you just decide to spend the whole week in Seattle and to spend the weekend in Portland? I don't know.
I've done it from one day to the next, and it's exhausting, absolutely exhausting.
Yeah, I can't imagine doing that every day. Well, I hope that everybody enjoyed that. The number one way that podcasts grow is by word of mouth. So if you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to share it with a friend, coworker, family member, whatever. Rate and review us on whatever platform you get your podcast on so that we rank higher in podcast listings. Subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And tweet at us or email us or send us a DM on Instagram to give us any thoughts and feedback or questions that you have. Next week, we're going to be talking to Marianne Williamson, the former presidential candidate. And Sylvia, what are we going to be talking to Marianne about?
We're going to be talking to Marianne about children's issues, specifically about her proposals on improving children's lives and something called the Whole Student Plan.
Well, I'm very excited about that. So if you want to be sure you see that, make sure that you subscribe so you don't miss it. And if you're sick of hearing me present in these last two episodes, you'll get a chance to hear Sylvia next week. So we'll see you next week.
See you next week.